You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 30th of March 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. This is The Globalist, live from London. I'm Tom Edwards.
And live in Zurich, I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up today, Italy continues to be at the centre of the pandemic here in Europe. We'll have the latest from Rome and Milan.
Also ahead,
the National Cabinet has been very clear that some states may have to take further measures sooner than other states. That is not a breakaway from the National Cabinet. That is actually the National Cabinet working.
Australian state premiers show the value of good leadership in the middle of a crisis.
Later, we'll cross to our bureau in Tokyo and speak to our Asia bureau chief there. And we'll be reading the headlines from a selection of European newspapers and business dailies.
We'll hear from Catherine Tait, the CEO of CBC and Radio-Canada, and find out how cinemas shutting their doors has meant a revival for the drive-in.
That's ahead of The Globalist, live from London and Zurich, here on Monocle 24.
A warm welcome indeed to today's Globalist. I am Tom Edwards here in London.
And I'm Tyler Brulé in Zurich. Good morning, Tom.
Morning, Tyler. It's quite exciting to be, well, I had to have one foot planted in each of these great cities this Monday morning.
Yeah, almost a snowy foot here as well as I was walking down to the studio. Just a light dusting starting this morning. We've had this amazing run of weather. It wasn't so great yesterday, but this morning it just feels like winter's kicked back in a little bit.
Yeah, a similar kind of feeling here in London town. Very sunny, but it was definitely getting chilly yesterday. Looking forward, though, Tyler, to warming the cockles with a great program in store. I think it's important to remind people that, you know, just because we are maybe sat, you know, 800 or 1,000 miles apart, we can still communicate. And this is our message to the world, isn't it? That we need to keep talking.
It is. And we've got a really, I think, interesting week and weeks, of course, coming up ahead. Not just obviously the key news story, which is dominating the world, Tom, but also a couple of tweaks you've been busy with, Andrew's been busy with, Carlotta, you know, various people, just slightly switching up the format. So our listeners, if you're starting with us this week, we've got a couple of innovations, you could call them, coming your way. Over even the coming hours.
Indeed, they are, Tyler. Shall I start with a couple of stories that
tell
we're watching
us what's going on
this day? Well, US President Donald Trump has said federal coronavirus guidelines will be extended until at least the 30th of April, significantly longer than he'd initially aspired to, he's now said. Japan's banning the entry of foreign citizens travelling from the US, China, South Korea and most of Europe in their bid to stop the spread of the virus. And South Korea's making an emergency cash payment to most families to ease the economic impact of the virus. We'll be having more, Tyler, on those stories. I'm sure we'll be talking about that Japan story with our Fiona Wilson a little later.
Yeah, indeed, we're going to be going to Japan, but first over to Italy. Of course, this is a story which dominates it, the European nation, really the hardest hit still to date here on the continent. We're going to cross now. We're going to speak to our Ivan Carvalho. Ivan is in Milan. He's our correspondent there. Also, Silvia Ciroli-Borelli is the Italy correspondent for Politico in Rome. Good morning, Silvia. The Italian story, like this entire story, it moves hour by hour. We seem to come out of the weekend almost that whether it was, of course, officials in Rome, but also further north in Italy, trying to certainly shine maybe a slightly more positive light on the story that they think that things might be settling down. But I'm wondering, how do we start the week?
Well, you know, the death toll right now stands at 10,779, which is an enormous number. And there are 3,815 new positives in the last 24 hours. So the numbers are still very concerning. But as you were saying, experts were pointing at the fact that they are slightly lower than the previous days, which means that the lockdown measures are working. And essentially what they're saying is that people have to hang in there and we'll get through it. But of course, the question is, when will we get through it? The health minister said last night that the lockdown measures that were initially scheduled to end April 3rd will have to be extended. And indeed, they will, because everyone realizes that with this death toll rising on a daily basis by a few hundreds, it's impossible to return to our ordinary lives just in 1 week time.
Well, let's bring in Ivan Carvalho. I think he's now joining us from his base in Milan. Ivan, good morning to you. And tell us a little bit about, well, I suppose a bigger picture. I was mentioning there this idea of, you know, getting through the worst. Italy perhaps might look to its EU colleagues. And I wonder, are we seeing a coherent approach from across the bloc? Is Italian PM happy with the kind of support he's getting from colleagues all across the continent?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Well, at the moment, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte would prefer to have much more of a European sort of cooperation regarding this crisis. You've seen recent comments regarding the fact that Italy and other countries were talking about these corona bonds, these a common debt instrument to help finance in this moment of you know, pandemic. And you've seen reactions from the northern countries and Germany and Holland, most notably the Dutch finance minister. And there's been responses to this sort of not very warm welcome, and that we're all in the same boat. You hear these comments being made by former Prime Minister Romano Prodi, who was at the EU himself, was saying that, you know, the Europeans need to get together. You know, what do the Dutch think if this crisis goes on? You know, who are they going to sell their tulips to? So, and you've heard other comments as well, even from the Portuguese Prime Minister, about the comments being repugnant from the Dutch about, you know, this is a time for solidarity. So you could say that in Rome, they were hoping for a much more sort of cohesive and coherent and sort of solidarity on the part of Brussels.
Sylvia, I wanted to ask you, I mean, on the back of that and that whole discussion about solidarity, certainly in the German language media, whether it's been, of course, in Germany, in Switzerland, quite a few stories about obviously airlifting the German Luftwaffe sending their special medevac planes into Italy to take very serious patients to Cologne, to Berlin. Has that even played out? I mean, there's so much to cover, or is that more of a story which is makes Germany feel good, or has Italy also recognized that also the EU, certainly EU partners, are trying to do something really very much in the day in terms of medical relief?
Well, parts of Italy and parts of the public have realized that it was in the news in Italy and it was tweeted out by various prominent figures. The story around the face masks was a similar one because in the end, Germany and France ended up unblocking exports and sending face masks and other protective equipment to Italy. But in the beginning, the issue was that these countries had blocked exports and Italy was in dire need of face masks and wasn't getting any from its European partners. Unfortunately, I think because of the past and the situation Italy has been in, including with the migration crisis and the fact it's lamented that it hasn't gotten much help from European partners, especially countries that were further up north and weren't feeling the strain that Italy was down in the southern part of the country, in the Mediterranean. This is a bit of a consequence of past tensions, because effectively Italy is now feeling a big economic impact. It is feeling the biggest hit so far from this coronavirus outbreak. So I think these positive stories, unfortunately, have become a bit more marginal compared to the main discussion over, as Ivan was saying, the corona bonds and these debt sharing instruments that northern countries with lower public debts don't want.
Well, Ivan, let's talk a bit more about the economic impact then. Its effect is clear and it's very severe. I wonder, are people already starting to try and look into the medium term and say, how can the country get out of this? Is there a big infrastructure play potentially? Do people feel it's almost, I don't know, indelicate to try and track that return to the sunlit uplands, given the gravity, the immediacy of the trouble which Italy is still in right now?
Well, it's, you know, it's quite difficult if you look at the numbers. You know, Italy in the average year, the flu season, will count up to 8,000-9,000 victims, you know, on average, and we're above 10,000, and that number will keep rising. Talking to restaurant owners, small businesses, and so on. Right now, the short term, there is basically lockdown. I talked to a restaurant owner yesterday who says he doesn't believe that anything will really happen until September. The schools, it looks like they won't reopen for the summer, so that's another thing. In terms of losses, there are a couple of projections I saw that best case and worst case, and they were ranging from $300 billion to upwards of $600-700 billion in terms of losses. And of course, we all know the hotels and tourism, which would be a major factor, looking at the summer season and spring season, basically wipe off the books. In Milan, we had the furniture fair canceled, which is a huge engine driver for the Milanese economy. If you look at the upside, sort of positive stories, the infrastructure thing might be something, because right now, while Italy is in lockdown, there are things going on in terms of public works. There is the Genoa bridge being rebuilt, and some are pointing to that as a model because the mayor of Genoa was given these special powers. And it may be a model to use in other places, perhaps to lower the red tape and bureaucracy, which Italy is known for, and to help sort of accelerate projects as we come out, when we come out of this lockdown.
Sylvia, is there a bit of a collective consciousness that maybe everything is, it is September now? This is going to be the time when things will, of course, kick back into gear. We've seen, of course, Salone, it moved once, it's now cancelled. We've seen the Venice Biennale architecture, of course, this year has moved again. Again, it is of course moving into autumn, but does that get cancelled again? So do you feel, whether it's both on a political side but also commercially, that everyone also feels that we just probably have to write off all of summer as well? Is Italy moving in that sort of direction?
I'm not sure if it's consciousness or fear, but it is going in that direction. I was talking to people here in Rome and in other parts of the country that haven't been hit as hard as Lombardy so far, that are still hoping that the outbreak doesn't affect them as much as the northern regions, and they're still hoping to save the summer season, either because they run tourist venues or because they have hotel management businesses. So it really depends. Right now, what the government has been speaking about is the impact on the economy through the month of May. No one has dared mention the possibility that this has to go on through the summer, especially because the summer in Italy attracts tourists, but also it means a lot for the economy in terms of everyone going on holiday and moving and leaving their homes. So clearly, if people are stuck at home over the summer, or the social distancing measures are carried forward, it means a lot to many different businesses. So essentially, that is the direction it's going in. But for example, they haven't even announced yet whether the school closure will be extended through the month of April. So we're still working with an April 3rd date. Everything is being taken one step at a time, probably to avoid panic, which I'm not sure is the greatest strategy, because of course it creates a lot of confusion as well. But people, some people at least in some parts of Italy, are hoping that this will be over soon. And, they're talking about May or June rather than September. So we'll have to see.
Sylvia Scudelli-Borelli in Rome, thank you very much for joining us. Thanks to our man in Milan, Ivan Carvalho, just before that. You're with The Brief, The Globalist, here on Monocle 24.
I know, Tom Edwards, so many programs to do. I mean, at the seat, at the desk the whole time. It's just coming up to 18:14 here in Zurich. It's 7:14 back in London, where Tom is. Well, in Australia, the virus is tightening its grip, and the Prime Minister is weighing up the risks of certainly shutting down the whole economy if people don't obey instructions at home. And of course, great weather over much of the country, a little bit of a late summer, you could say. Some state counterparts are pressing ahead with their own closures, leaving unity amongst leaders looking a bit frayed. Political journalist Karen Middleton reports from Canberra for us.
Out here between the Pacific and Indian Oceans, the island continent Australia is becoming a fortress. Except for ship's passengers needing medical treatment and the last few citizens racing to fly home, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has announced that Australia's borders are closed.
The overwhelming proportion of cases in Australia have been imported. And the measures we've put in place has obviously had an impact on that. And this is a further measure now that will ensure that that can be further enhanced.
Within those borders, the normal rules of national governance have also changed to match these extraordinary times. To manage the response to COVID-19, Prime Minister Morrison has formed a national cabinet with the premiers of the six Australian states and chief ministers of its two mainland territories. Five are from the centre-left Labor Party and four, including Morrison, are from the centre-right Liberals, who, in Australia, are the Conservatives. Before the National Cabinet, Australians had complained of inadequate information about the virus and confusing messages. There was panic in the supermarkets. Police had to be called. The new system brought greater calm and cohesion, initially. But that was 2 weeks ago, when confirmed coronavirus cases across Australia numbered only 200. Now there are almost 4,000 in a country with only 2,000 intensive care hospital beds. Just a week after the National Cabinet's formation, several members started going it alone. They rejected the Prime Minister's position that schools nationwide should stay open and children should attend. He was arguing that essential workers were needed elsewhere, not home with kids, and that medical advice said closure wasn't necessary. But in Australia, the states run the schools, and under pressure from worried parents, those leaders encouraged students to stay away. The states run the hospitals too, so with the infection rate still climbing alarmingly, the most populous states, Victoria and New South Wales, also aren't waiting for national consensus on whether a widespread community lockdown is needed, a last resort move to keep people at home. Prime Minister Morrison wants Australians to do it voluntarily. But images of oblivious crowds on Sydney's famous Bondi Beach last weekend horrified the leaders and partially forced their collective hand. So they closed popular beaches and all businesses nationwide running group or social activities, including gyms, hotels, restaurants and cafes, indefinitely. They also closed enterprises offering close contact personal services. But the moves saw hundreds of thousands registering at the welfare office known as Centrelink. That has the Prime Minister reluctant to go further, fearful a full national lockdown could completely destroy the economy and leave millions out of work. Many in the medical community warn drastic measures are needed urgently to stop the spread of the virus, or the system will be overrun. Victoria's Labor Premier Daniel Andrews says he's listening to them.
We've got queues at Centrelink offices. That's heartbreaking. What we don't want is queues for people who need a machine to help them breathe. We cannot have people queuing for intensive care beds. That will mean they will die.
The Prime Minister denies his National Cabinet is split.
The National Cabinet has been very clear that some states may have to take further measures sooner than other states. That is not a breakaway from the National Cabinet. That is actually the National Cabinet working.
His Belgian-born Finance Minister Matthias Cormann describes the fight they're in.
We are making our judgments based on the medical advice from the chief medical officers from around Australia. We're not going to start gratuitously shutting down businesses because we are under political pressure. I mean, in the end, it is a war on two fronts.
Those fronts involve life and health and the economy. Protecting one will seriously harm the other. But the premiers of the two biggest states believe going harder sooner will be better in the long run. So Australia's biggest cities, Sydney and Melbourne, where the virus has the strongest grip, will soon see restrictions others may not. The federal government desperately hopes the rest of the nation doesn't have to follow, but many retailers are making their own decisions, shutting their doors regardless. And the Australian people are left wondering exactly who to listen to, and like the rest of the world, whether things will ever be the same again. For Monocle in Canberra, this is Karen Middleton.
Thanks very much to Karen for that report here on The Globalist. Plenty still to come on the programme. We'll be sitting down with Catherine Tait, the CEO of CBC and Radio Canada.
We have been designated by our provincial governments as an essential service, not just the public broadcaster, but all media. And We take that responsibility very seriously, and it is an important reminder, I think, to the citizens and the populations of all the countries that have the benefit of a truly arm's-length public broadcaster.
We'll be hearing more from Catherine Tait a little later in the programme. Tyler, I'm sure you'll be looking forward to that one.
Of course, I always want to hear from my fellow country folk. Tom, it's interesting. We've been speaking a little bit about just the role of public service broadcasters. We've been touching on this on a variety of programs. And you know, when we have the mop-up after all of this, it will be very interesting to see, you know, is the discussion where there's been so much narrative on either side of the political spectrum about, you know, should we be putting more money and throwing more money at public broadcasters? Do they need to behave more like private sector actors? Do you think that this sort of heats up after all of this? Have we seen public service broadcasters really sort of, you know, come to the forefront in many markets or many countries, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I wonder whether it strangely could have a sort of democratizing effect. I think people are being more objective and picky about where they get the news. And I think they've seen that some of these big players may be a bit encumbered by other responsibilities and that they haven't been able to be as dexterous as perhaps they could have been in responding to, you know, this, the unprecedented nature of the crisis. It could be something that further maybe levels the landscape for, I don't know, some ambitious independent players, Tyler.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating to watch. And I think also the quality, certainly, and we come back to always just presentation, you know, what are the main anchors? What are the main reporters saying? And, you know, in very crowded media landscapes, and there's also a bigger question, you know, where do people turn? Do you say, look, you're going to go to your traditional channel one or channel two, or do you end up on a private sector rolling news service? And often we know, you know, that can be quite a partisan experience in a way. Tom, let's cross over to Tokyo now. Our bureau chief in our bureau is there, Fiona Wilson. Fiona, we were chatting yesterday, and good afternoon to you. Tokyo is in a lockdown situation this weekend, or at least semi-lockdown. Some things are open, as you said. What's happened this morning? This is one thing we were sort of speculating. It's one thing to close the city down just for a 48-hour period. What happens on a busy Monday morning, especially at a time of year, as we know, when this is Japan's sort of new business year starts?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we did talk about this yesterday, how yesterday we saw a lot of businesses closed, a few things open, very few people on the streets. Today, I wouldn't say it's business as usual. It's like the volume's been turned down. Most things are open, but very, very quiet. Shibuya, where the office is, you know, usually a very, very quiet area, very, very busy area. Sorry. And today it just feels a bit muted. And there are a lot of rumours that there is going to be much more of a permanent lockdown. It's not just going to be a weekend thing. And the Nikkei fell quite dramatically this morning. And, you know, I think the feeling is that Shinzo Abe is building up to making some more imposing restrictions very soon.
Now, Fiona, people will have been hearing in our wrap of the main stories, of course, this travel ban coming into force. Is there a sense where you are that actually this is long overdue, and this obviously is about restrictions on travellers from China, from the US, and from some other key markets. I don't know if it's too little, too late. Is it too late?
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked about this yesterday, and I think the feeling is it has certainly, you know, been long overdue. I think there's been a feeling, actually, for really quite a long time, pretty much since the end of January, that there, you know, and certainly now we're, you know, end of March, really, it's quite amazing they haven't been more restrictive. So they're now saying the, you know, the list is going to have, yes, the US, China, South Korea, most of Europe, some parts of Southeast Asia. And I think, you know, the amazing thing, it hasn't happened sooner. And yeah, I think that will relieve people. It's certainly been a feeling that people have been coming in. The quarantine regulations have been a little opaque. It's quite hard for people. Often they don't know they're breaking the regulations. They're just heading off into Japan without really many restrictions. So I think making it much clearer by just saying people simply can't come in is probably going to make many people feel a bit of relief today.
Fiona, you mentioned that, of course, we've seen the Nikkei drop as a result of this. It's really almost in parallel, though, we hear a huge discussion, of course, Prime Minister Abe talking about a massive stimulus, one unlike Japan has ever seen. So do you think this is also, he's maybe recognized the mistakes that other countries have made? One thing to announce lockdown, but we now sort of know with the luxury of a couple of weeks, if you talk lockdown, you really need to do that as a package deal with a big stimulus program.
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, they've been talking about the stimulus before the lockdown. You know, and Shinzo Abe's been saying that the stimulus will be much bigger than it was after 2008, when it was already absolutely enormous. Yeah, I mean, obviously, people are very nervous, businesses are nervous. And I think looking at other countries, what people know is that the moment you start talking about lockdown, you get the panic buying. You know, the lockdown begins from that moment, really. So I think he wants to get things into place. And, you know, and also talking about no collateral loans for small businesses. You know, as we've seen everywhere, small businesses, the margins are tight. They're going to go to the wall very, very quickly. So the feeling is that maybe he wants to get things in place. But I think events are really, really overtaking in terms of infection rate in Tokyo was up again yesterday. It's every day increasing. It's particularly Tokyo that people are looking at. So I think really something will have to happen. At the moment, you've got today sort of a normal day. At the moment, they haven't said anything about schools. They're supposed to be going back, you know, 6th and 7th of April. Very hard to believe that will be happening. But at the moment, they haven't made that announcement. So this is an interesting day. I think, you know, we could see Shinzo Abe speaking tomorrow and maybe some more news tomorrow evening.
We'll watch and look on with interest. Fiona Wilson, Monocle's Asia Bureau Chief in Tokyo, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on The Globalist. Here's a quick recap of what we're keeping an eye on today. US President Donald Trump has said federal coronavirus guidelines, such as social distancing, will be extended across the country until at least the 30th of April. He'd previously suggested they could be relaxed as early as Easter. Trump's now said that was merely an aspiration. Japan is banning the entry of foreign citizens travelling from the US, China, South Korea and most of Europe to stop the spread of the virus. While Japanese nationals are not affected, the travel ban suggests Prime Minister Shinzo Abe might consider declaring a national state of emergency. And South Korea will make an emergency cash payment to most families to ease the economic impact of the pandemic. President Moon Jae-in said the emergency disaster relief payment of up to 1 million won, that's around 735 euros, would be made to all households outside the top 30% by income. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Stay tuned.
And we're just coming up to the bottom of the hour. It's what's sort of, as Tom and I were just talking before, we were sort of asking about the role of public broadcasters during a pandemic. How do they adapt? How are nations kept up to date and reassured? And how do they keep up their manifesto to inform, educate, and entertain? Well, our Robert Bound, our culture editor, speaks to the CEO of CBC and Radio-Canada, Catherine Tate, about the challenges that Canada state broadcasters overcome over the past few weeks.
First and foremost, we had to pay attention to the health and safety of our own people. I mean, we have about 9,000 people who work for CBC Radio-Canada across the country. And to the extent that we could redeploy people to work remotely, we did so immediately. So we have about 40% of our news staff working from home now. And so that covers off all the radio shows, the podcasts, and obviously all the content that we produce online. So that was step number one, make sure our people are safe. And then for the people who were coming into the newsrooms, and again, we have 60 locations, so we had a lot of logistics here, had to ensure that those people are safe. So that meant, and as you know, modern 21st century newsrooms are big rooms, open rooms, sometimes with as many as 200 people in them working in very close quarters. And for television news production, also very labor intensive. So having to figure out logistics like, okay, forget hair and makeup. We're not going to have those people doing that work anymore. Our news hosts are doing their own hair and makeup. Sounds like a trivial detail, but it was literally at that level that we had to start looking at how do we ensure the production and delivery of news, up-to-the-minute news, constant news, at volumes we've never seen before, but in a way that's safe for the people in the newsroom.
I know you wrote a letter to the Financial Times recently, citing the Danish national broadcaster and the BBC as well, and talking about how public service broadcasting is in dark times. It's been accused of certain things. It's under the cosh to a certain extent. Can you see a crisis like this kind of in giving people sort of fresh confidence in their public broadcasters, seeing how close they can track their movements and how intimate they can be, how knowledgeable they can be, and actually that this is an opportunity that is a sad one for many, but is a very real one for public broadcasters such as the CBC?
Well, it's for sure. I think that's exactly right. Again, this is our moment. We are, obviously, we don't compare to the first responders and the health workers, the paramedics, the nurses, all of the people that are on the front lines of actually dealing with people who may or may not, you know, may be sick or may be dying. Obviously, we don't put ourselves into that category. But we have been designated by our provincial governments as an essential service, not just the public broadcaster, but all media. And we take that responsibility very seriously. And it is an important reminder, I think, to the citizens and the populations of all the countries that have the benefit of a truly arm's length public broadcaster that, you know, we're here to serve. And we do it not just in the news, doubling down on news or augmenting the flow of accurate information about the virus and about services to help people in these very, very dire times. But we're also serving in ways that are kind of, you know, focused on helping our citizens deal with the stress and the pressures of this pandemic. So all of us are focusing on children. You know, in our case, we've opened up our educational, what was an OTT service only to educational institutions and libraries. We've just opened it up to everyone. You know, so kids, parents at home have a chance to go on curio.ca and see a whole lot of educational content. You know, we've increased the amount of content available on our OTT platforms for kids. And we've activated and enlisted our kid journalists, because we've got a thing called Kids News here, and in French it's called Mon Actualité du Jour. And those children are actually reporting on COVID from their homes and helping other children in Canada deal with a very extraordinary circumstances. So all of those things, I think it's, you really have to look at the, you know, the full basket of offerings, and then you'll really understand. And I hope that our citizens here in Canada and yours in Britain and in Australia across the world will understand, boy, that public broadcaster isn't just providing me with my evening news. They're doing a whole lot more.
Catherine Tate there, the CEO of CBC and Radio Canada. And to hear the full interview, tune into Monocle on Culture tonight here on Monocle 24. This week's show is exploring the role of public service broadcasters during the pandemic. Here tonight at 20:00 London time, this is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
As we head towards 8 a.m. here in London, let's continue with a dive into some of the day's newspapers. Joining us today is the author and political journalist Terry Stiassny. Terry, sorry not to have you around the table shuffling the papers next to me here in Studio One, but nevertheless, you've been busy browsing for us. And I think there's a French accent maybe to the first couple of picks you've got for us.
Yes, interesting. I mean, the French paper Libération, which always has a kind of a very dramatic front page image. Today's image is a picture with a big headline that says coronavirus le crash test, which with sort of a phrase that probably the Académie Française wouldn't approve of. And they've got a big image there of a medic holding out a testing kit, and they're all in their protective gear. And the article in the paper says the headlines on the front say, the French government is being criticised for its lack of testing and that it's attempting to make up time. And they're comparing the arguments in, say, France, the US, Spain and the UK with Korea and Germany, where the paper argues that the testing has been more efficient. On the inside page, they're quoting the French health minister, Olivier Véran, saying that they have ordered 5 million rapid tests and that he is planning to increases tests, sort of doubling them from 30,000 extra ones in April to 60,000 in May, up to 100,000 tests a day in June. The paper is reporting that, you know, even some of the basic things that you need for these tests, so I don't know, you know, you've seen those long cotton swabs that people are using to test for coronavirus, saying that France has imported 100% of those. And of course, at the moment, they're finding it hard to get hold of even the basic things, the basic swabs, to be able to carry out the test. And so there's kind of big worries there in France about the testing system.
Terry, good morning from Zurich. You've also got a story from Le Figaro, and this is really about the transfer of patients across borders. Over the weekend in Switzerland, there was a lot of stories as well. French military helicopters bringing patients to Geneva, to Basel. We've seen the same thing from Germany. How does this play out in France? Do you have any sense of, is this not seen as an embarrassment? Is this magnanimous on the part of neighbours? What is the mood about that? Because France loves their healthcare system.
They do. I think one of the big concerns in France, and obviously this is just, you know, from sitting in London and looking at it and hearing from, you know, from friends in France, they are worried that about the extent to which it's been so far regionalized. They're particularly worried, I think, is the situation in what they call the Grand Est in the east of France, so the area around Strasbourg. And they're noticing that, you know, that particular area, they've long been saying, we haven't got the resources to cope with the cases here. I think what I don't know personally, I think would be interesting to know, is why that particular area has been, has been so badly hit. But I think it's quite a good symbol of cooperation in that, you know, the French and German military, who obviously work together on many issues, and they are able in this case to increase the number of patients that they're transferring to southwest Germany, where, you know, because of course Germany so far, you know, fortunately for them, has been less badly hit, and certainly in terms of fatalities where the coronavirus is concerned.
Let's head a little further east from Strasbourg, Terry, and look at Austria. I know you've found an interesting piece from Der Standard today, and that's about, you know, Easter is almost upon us. Now, you know, Donald Trump had offered what he now claims was merely an aspiration, that the US would be all better by Easter. But it poses a different kind of problem, and it exerts, I guess, a social pressure. And that's what this piece is about.
Yes, that's it. I mean, Austria, of course, has had, you know, quite strict measures fairly early on. You know, one of the rules in Austria is you're not allowed to meet in groups of more than five people, which they were doing, you know, a good couple of weeks before similar restrictions came in elsewhere in Europe. And again, they've seen, you know, a relatively low increase in cases. But apparently, according to the Der Standard, government sources saying their government is worried about Easter, and they're saying that restrictions will certainly have to stay in place till Easter, because they think Easter is a motivation basically for people to break the rules, to come out of their isolation. And they're saying that, you know, because Easter is often is celebrated as a family festival, and it's a time for families to get together, and people will have to be told quite clearly that, you know, this year round Easter is not going to be able to be a family festival, and that you will have to stay at home, and that only after that is there any going to be any possibility at all of decreasing the controls on people's movements. And again, seeing that exams will be cancelled, and talking about what's going to happen to school pupils, you know, after what would normally be the Easter holiday.
Terry, we're going to keep going. Maybe now we're counterclockwise around the continent, up to Sweden. The Times has a story. A lot of people have been focusing on Sweden and this rather unique Swedish approach of, I mean, very, very, let's say, lockdown light, or not even lockdown. You could almost say just much more instructional in a way, a very, very Swedish collective approach. People are responsible for their neighbors and how they behave in society, which has also left a lot of people confused, and also has left the medical community very divided. And you pick up on that story from the Times today.
Yes, the Times is reporting that, and it says, they're saying here that Stefan Löfven, the Prime Minister, although he tightened restrictions over the weekend, these are not restrictions that most of us in the rest of Europe would think very restrictive at all, limiting gatherings to 50 people, and saying, for instance, you know, there's quite strange distinctions here. So you're allowed to go to a bar, but you're not allowed to stand at a bar, but you can still have sit down at a restaurant table. Ski resorts, gyms and hairdressers remain open. Secondary schools and university are closed, but preschools and primary schools are still open. And so although the death toll in Sweden has apparently risen sharply over the past few days with up to 105 deaths, and there does seem to be criticism from, you know, from their neighbours in Denmark, worrying about whether Sweden is taking the crisis seriously enough. And but the Sweden's chief epidemiologist Anders Tegnell says that these policies are more sustainable and effective in protecting the public's health than harsh measures. I mean, that is the kind of argument that we had heard here in the UK, saying, you know, that, you know, before these more stricter limits in the UK came in, suggesting that, well, people wouldn't put up with this for long. And I think that's also something that's slightly hinted at in the Austrian situation, the worries that, you know, people will suddenly think, well, oh, it's Easter, or, you know, I've had enough of this now and I'm going to just ignore these restrictions.
One imagines, Terry, they're either going to look very clever or potentially rather stupid in 3 or 4 months. We shall see. Just briefly, Terry, I must ask you another story you picked out in the Times, which is about the world's oldest man right here in Blighty. He's had to cancel his birthday. We'll wish Bob our very best anyway. Just tell us, how's he marking the day? He can't have his party.
He's Bob Whiten. He is 112. He lives in Alton in Hampshire, and he had to celebrate in self-isolation yesterday, speaking to his large family by phone. I think the sort of the message we can take from Bob is a certain kind of philosophical acceptance of what's going on. He said that he was 10 when Spanish flu killed millions in 1918. He said he'd been in situations where you just had to accept what was happening. In the First World War, I was just a child, and I just had to accept there were air raids that all the adults were scared about. I didn't understand what was going on. And then he had an even more dramatic experience in the Second World War. He was sailing with his wife and son from Taiwan, got to Hawaii. We were told that war had broken out in Europe and we couldn't go to Britain anyway. So having your plans interrupted and confronted by new situations that you could do nothing about is not really new to me. There's nothing we can do about it, so you might as well do what you can, never mind about the things that you can't.
Well, well said, Bob. We'll all drink to that sentiment, and happy birthday to him as well. Terry, always good to hear from you. That was the political journalist and author Terry Stiassny guiding us through some of the day's newspapers here on The Globalist.
And it's just gone 8:41 in Zurich, 7:41 back in London, where Tom is. How's your Monday so far? 41 minutes into the programme, Tom.
Pretty good, Tyler. Going smoothly. I just wondered, I like the fact that the Swedes say you can't stand in a bar, but if you sit down, go for it. It's an interesting take.
Yeah, it's a curious one. And I wonder if we're a bit of a, we'll be covering this maybe a little bit closer. I think we're at a tipping point. As we said, a lot of, you know, misunderstanding. I think what we've seen through all of this, you need very, very clear messaging. And I think when, you know, things look a little bit half-half, people don't really, you know where to go. And maybe I think we saw the same thing, perhaps, Tom, in the UK after Boris's first announcements as well.
Absolutely, Tyler. And there was this measure of confusion. And as ever, you need clarity from leaders. On that subject, Tyler, I know that was something that you were talking about just this past weekend. I don't know if regular globalist listeners are tuning in as well to your Monocle on Sunday show. But this idea about what great leadership looks like.
What kind of question is that?
But I'm just reminding, in case there's any sure. Converts waiting. But this idea of, Tyler, framing these questions about great leadership was something that you got into yesterday.
Yeah, we were talking to Rob Cox, and he's the global editor of Reuters Breaking Views. And it was just interesting. He was like really, he was comparing what we've seen from Sacramento and from Albany, from both governors, and maybe raising a couple of questions as to what the Democratic convention could look like. Should we really say that we could see an enormous upset? Maybe not. But one thing we were looking at when you think about clear leadership, Tom, was maybe following sort of the company board approach that Switzerland has to running government. Anyway, here's what Rob had to say.
I really think that we're going to reassess the definition of leadership as a result of this crisis all around the world. And I don't mean just in the U.S. or political context, but in our companies, the way we all operate, the way our CEOs operate, the way they communicate, the way they handle these ructions in our communities, in our churches, in our houses of worship, everywhere. I think people are seeing new leaders or really better leaders emerge, hospitals and schools, first responders. And I think that's just going to change the way we define the resumes or even the job descriptions that we have, whether it's chief executive officer of a company, whether it's commander in chief of the United States. And I think 10 weeks or even 4 to 6 weeks or whatever it might be of isolation like this and watching people like Andrew Cuomo or Gavin Newsom, who I think you were referencing as the governor of California, or even Jim DeWine, who's the Republican governor of Ohio. They're all putting themselves forward and they're jumping into this void of leadership that we're seeing all over the place, particularly at the U.S. federal government level or in the early stages of the crisis. And I think it's not inconceivable that we might have a different view about the wisdom of appointing or naming or electing people in their late 70s, for instance, to these jobs. I mean, we're going to have a different view about age as a result of this, the deadly virus that is taking out people of a certain, of seniors. So it would not surprise me to see that by the time we get to the convention in July, should there be a convention in July, that people, particularly Democratic delegates, might rethink their choice of Joe Biden, who is certainly has compassion, but it's not obvious that he's the right guy for the job. And I would not be surprised to see a surprise. Mm.
And just before we go, you said there was something interesting. You know, you're sitting in Switzerland, and we've talked a little bit about the Federal Council, how that really behaves like a corporate board. You said maybe someone should be paying attention to Bern a little bit. Of course, America, which is everyone looks up to, you know, so often, you know, the billionaire industrial leaders, et cetera, you know, maybe there's a page to be taken from here that you really put forward, whatever you want to call it, your new cabinet, but you have this top flight team.
Yeah, I mean, you could always, if Joe Biden is the guy or Donald Trump, or he could do this too, say, I will be the chairman of the board. I will appoint a CEO. My cabinet will be my board of directors. I will rethink the way the presidency is run. I mean, that would be a great way that you could copy in some respects the corporate model. Not that corporations are infallible, but they certainly have, or even the military model, which is, you know, has years and years of practice at trying to figure out the right level of management and chain of command. The example in Switzerland is fascinating. When I first moved here, and I remember asking even Swiss friends, I was like, so who is the president of Switzerland? Like, maybe half of them knew who it was at the time. Now, I think they do know now because in this crisis, the president, obviously, she stepped up, as it were. She had to do so. But I don't think it's a terrible model at all. Of course, you know, the idea that you could revamp a country like the United States, you know, in a heartbeat to do something like, you know, creates a model like this, hard to imagine. But again, we're going through something that is once in a, you know, this hasn't really happened, I'm not sure, really ever. I mean, I don't think 1918 is analogous. So we cannot really say for certainty what attitudes will be like in 10 weeks' time, but I know they will be different than they are today. And that will have huge ramifications for the way we view leadership.
Rob Cox there, the global editor of Reuters Breaking Views, talking to me yesterday here in Zurich. We're going to keep it here. I'm happy to say Mark Dittley is joining us. He's the editor of The Market, one of the publications from the NZZ. He's not in studio. He's across town. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Tyler.
Let's start, and I hope all's well on your side of town, and we look forward to having you back around the table here. But you know, a variety of things that certainly happening in this country. But maybe we should start with the finance minister Uli Maurer making some pretty big pledges last week. We've been reporting that Switzerland's been pretty good and being, you know, very on point in terms of communicating the packages available. But what have we heard from Mr. Maurer of late?
He last week announced a program in which small and medium-sized enterprises can apply for bridge loans. Because, as you know, given the widespread shutdown that we have in the economy here, there are tens of thousands of small and medium-sized companies who are seeing their cash flow just drying up, and they need money. They're in urgent need of money. So that program is actually administered by the banks but guaranteed by the Swiss government, where small companies can apply for a loan. And the finance minister, Uli Maurer, said the loans will be given within 30 minutes. It's not working quite that fast. It's not 30 minutes, but the program started last Thursday, and until now, tens of thousands of companies have already been handed out loans. So it seems to be working rather efficiently.
Mark Morgans from me, Tom, here in London. Let me ask you about an industry or a sector, I suppose, that, you know, is worried that it's not going to be working, not just not efficiently, but potentially not at all. And that's the sort of hospitality sector, tourism. Some, well, frankly, rather alarming figures are knocking about. Tell us what they might reveal.
Yeah, the tourism industry is of course one of the most hardest hit, and tourism is a bit is an important sector in Switzerland. Hotels, restaurants, they employ about, these are just rough figures, about 250,000 employees. Now, the main tabloid paper here in Switzerland, Blick, is citing a study this morning which says that about one third of all hotel establishments are at risk of bankruptcy. Now, of course, this all is depending on how long this shutdown will last. All these hotels and restaurants, they all can apply for bridge loans, so they are not at the verge of bankruptcy right now. But of course, if this drags on for months, it'll be very difficult. Just to give you one figure, in the canton of Graubünden, which is one of the mountain cantons, where with resorts such as St. Moritz and Davos, 92% of all hotels are shut down right now. Only 8% are still in operation.
Mark, we've also heard, of course, that the government will be putting a lot of money into tourism, certainly not just to maybe prop up and of course, help enterprise, but also to remind people to come to Switzerland as well. Do you just have a sense, and I know we're going to go and talk about the airline in a second, but do you have a sense of, do you think also the Swiss are probably going to stay within their own borders? Or do you think after all of this, they're like, get us out of here. We can't wait to get to Corsica. We can't wait to jump on a plane to the Canaries. Can you sense the mood here a little bit?
It's really difficult to say right now because, as you know, most of us have to stay at home. I can well imagine that once these shutdown measures are lifted, there'll be a lot of people who will say, "Okay, I'll stay within Switzerland for a while." Also, you know, just to help the domestic tourism industry to get back on its feet again. Maybe the times of when we were hopping to Phuket or wherever just for a week or so, they might be over for quite a while.
Just two quick ones before we go. Obviously, if you can fly over, if on one of those few remaining flights out of Zurich, you can go over Kloten, the main airport, Dubendorf, the Air Force base nearby, and you will see scores and scores of Swiss aircraft grounded. And there's only a handful of routes, maybe 8 or 9 routes that they're still keeping open. There's obviously a discussion, though. This is a flag carrier, emotionally very important to the country, been bailed out once before. But, of course, there is a discussion going on with Bern. And yet it's also a bit tricky because Swiss, even though it's flying the flag, is owned by Lufthansa.
Yeah, that's a big discussion right now. As you just said, most of the fleet of Swiss International Airlines is grounded. I just drove past Dubendorf Air Force Field yesterday, and it's quite a sight of seeing all these airliners mothballed there, really. There's a very high probability that the Swiss government will have to bail out Swiss in some way. You've seen over the weekend the Singapore government has given Singapore Airlines a huge capital boost. Now, the added twist, as you mentioned, Swiss Airlines is not a Swiss company. It's actually owned by Deutsche Lufthansa. It's a full subsidiary of Deutsche Lufthansa. So there's obviously a bit of a discussion. You know, is this now a Swiss company that should be bailed out by the Swiss government, or is it a German company where the German taxpayer should really carry the burden? I think we will see a form of bailout by the Swiss government because it's, after all, it's the flag carrier here in Switzerland.
Yeah, Mark Dittley, great to speak with you. There was another story we wanted to check to you about. The Swiss are running out of gold, of all things. We may have to get you back later in the day to join us on the briefing to talk more about that. But thanks for your time this Monday morning. That's our Mark Dittley in Zurich joining us here on The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Ticking towards 9 o'clock in Zurich, nearly 8 o'clock here in London. Time, though, Tyler, if you'll join me, for a trip to the drive-in. One of the unlikely beneficiaries, perhaps, of all of this financial and economic and social uncertainty.
I love that. Tom, what kind of car are we going in?
I think it's got to be a big old Buick, Tyler. How do you feel about that?
I'm not great about it, actually. Okay. I've got to be honest.
Well, climbing in to join us is our good friend, the film critic, Karen Krzanowicz. Karen, great to hear from you. Thanks for being with us. The drive-in, a resurgence, is this just stateside? Is it happening all around the world where they still have loads of drive-ins?
Incredibly, yes. There's been a resurgence in Canada and South Korea, Dublin. It seems to be global wherever you've got space and you've got a car culture of some sort. But even before COVID-19, drive-ins were gaining popularity. People just wanted to get out and get off on being online. As much as one would want to read a printed newspaper or magazine, you want to go back to something different. But of late, even though last weekend the box office was saying, the American box office was saying, zero revenue for films, the first time it's ever happened. Well, actually, no. There's a small percentage of, and they don't take stats from drive-in, strangely enough. So there's been a small percentage keeping the box office going, ticking over. But people stress that it's only 5 to 10% of existing drive-ins, but there are a lot of pop-ups as well.
Karen, I need to ask you, your first memories, your last memories as a child who grew up on the other side of the Atlantic. I can vaguely remember mine in Manitoba. When was the last time you were at a drive-in?
What was your first one? Do you remember?
I think it was, I don't remember what it was, but Tom, it could have been in a Buick. I don't think we had a Buick. I think we had, but we definitely had a wood paneled station wagon. I know that much I do know. And I was bundled up in the back seat and very, very cozy, but then my parents lost me at that point.
Oh, well, we had a Chrysler and I remember it being huge. And cause my parents went all the time. I was raised in a real cinema going family. Every week we would go no matter what. And I remember seeing Night of the Grizzly, it scared the bejesus out of me because we were parked next to the woods. So we're watching, a man-eating bear movie, and there's a woods right next to the car. But also, my parents used to leave us home and go and see Russ Meyer movies at the drive-in, and I could never figure out why they left us home. And, wait a minute, you've seen that one before. Why are you going? So obviously, there was something going on there that my child, like mine, couldn't grasp. But the last one I saw was a revival of Jaws on the big screen, which I loved. It's a great experience. And what you forget is if you've got a family or you've got a lot of friends, and this is what's great about the COVID-19 crisis for drive-ins, is that you can bundle your kids or your friends or whoever you're living with in the back, turn the car around and drop the back gate if you've got a hatchback. And it's great. You're under the stars, you're looking up, and as long as it doesn't rain, you're in good shape.
Karen, time is short, but very briefly, what's the perfect drive-in movie then? Given all of this tumult around the world, is it escapism? Presumably you avoid, contagion and films like that. What should you be watching to get your mind off it?
I think a good musical, a good Hollywood musical, and generally these things are done in double bills so you can have adventures and musicals, something big that'll just suck you right into it and make you forget your blues.
Sounds good to me. Tyler, what would be your choice if you were back in that wood paneled station wagon again?
Now I'm going Sound of Music, but it wouldn't be appropriate to be in a wood paneled station wagon. A vehicle made in Austria, maybe a Mercedes G-Wagon, something like that. Karen Krzanowicz, great to talk to you. That's all for today's program. Our producer today was Carlotta Ribello, our researcher Charlie Fillmore Court, and our studio manager David Stevens, with editing assistance from Louise Allen.
Tyler, Stella, there's plenty more to look forward to today. Lots of great radio on the way in the next hour. Stay with me. I've a few little audio treats for you, and we have a sensational big interview coming up in the next hour. After nine, more sensational radio. Another chance to hear the Foreign Desk exploring a century of multilateralism. It is the programme you need to hear right now, not to be missed.
And I need to tell our listeners, Tom Edwards, you're back at midday with the briefing in London. I'll probably join in as well. The Globalist returns at the same time tomorrow. But for me, Tyler Brulé in Zurich.
And for me, Tom Edwards, here at Midori House in London.
Have a good day. Thanks for listening.